Welcome to the Robotics Brief. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Glad to be here.
Today, we're talking about a kind of quiet revolution, or maybe just a quiet realignment, happening in how we think about robots and language models, specifically how they perceive and learn from the world around them.
You're seeing a realignment? Honestly, I'm seeing more of a scramble to fix fundamental flaws that we maybe glossed over because the demos looked cool.
Maybe it's both, Sam. But what struck me going through these papers is how many of them are implicitly grappling with the idea that our models aren't actually seeing or understanding in the way we assume they are. We give them video, we give them text, and we expect a coherent, grounded understanding. But the reality is often much more brittle.
Yeah, that brittle part is key. It's like we've built these incredibly sophisticated pattern matching machines, and then we're surprised when they don't have human-level common sense or perception. It's a reminder that intelligence isn't just about processing data. It's about what data you prioritize and how you interpret it.
Precisely. And the first paper, Mitigating Perceptual Judgment Bias, really hammers that home. They found that multimodal LLM judges, when faced with conflicting visual and textual evidence, tend to reward plausible narratives over perceptually correct answers.
That's wild. So if the text says something that sounds right, but the image clearly shows something else, the model often just ignores what it sees? It defaults to the story?
Exactly. They call it perceptual judgment bias. The MLLM will anchor on the response text, even when its own visual perception should tell it otherwise. It leads to inconsistent, non-verifiable evaluations. And that's not just an academic curiosity, is it?
No, it's not. It's a fundamental problem if you want these models to interact with the real world in any meaningful way. How can a robot make decisions if its internal judge prioritizes a plausible lie over empirical observation? You're basically building a robot that can be gaslit by its own internal narrative.
It makes you wonder about the architectural choices, doesn't it? Are we perhaps giving too much weight to the language components or integrating them in a way that doesn't properly ground them in the visual data? The paper uses perceptual perturbation to expose this, essentially messing with the images to see when the model breaks.
Right, and that's what makes the timing weird. You have a model that can't even tell the difference between what it's told and what it sees, and then we're trying to scale up data generation for robot learning with things like RoboDream.
RoboDream, that's our next one. It's about generating photorealistic demonstrations for robot learning, creating novel objects and novel scenes. The goal is to tackle the prohibitive cost of real-world data collection.
Which, I get it, data collection is expensive. But they talk about how existing methods suffer from embodiment hallucinations and physically infeasible motions. So we're generating data for robots that might not actually be physically possible? That feels like another layer of abstraction that could go very wrong.
The key difference here, Sam, is that RoboDream is built on a generalizable embodiment-centric world model. They're trying to synthesize demonstrations with a stronger grasp on physics and embodiment, so the generated data is actually useful for training. It's not just visual augmentation. It's about simulating plausible robot interactions.
Okay, but how do they guarantee physical feasibility? Is there an underlying physics engine, or is it still a generative model trying to approximate physics? Because approximating physics with an LLM is a different beast entirely from having a hard constraint.
They don't explicitly detail the underlying physics, but the emphasis on embodiment-centric suggests a move beyond just superficial visual changes. They're aiming for compositional world models that understand how objects interact and how a robot body moves within that space. It's about generating a plan that's physically sound, not just a pretty video.
And that's a huge distinction, because if the data we're feeding our learning models is subtly, or not so subtly, flawed in terms of physical reality, then all the downstream learning is going to be built on a house of cards. We've seen that before.
Yeah, we have. And it ties into the third paper, Proto-ADA, on multimodal continual instruction tuning. They're trying to help MLLMs continually acquire new vision language capabilities without suffering from inter-task interference.
That's the classic catastrophic forgetting problem, isn't it? Train it on one thing, and it forgets the last thing it learned. For multimodal models, that's even harder, because you're trying to keep the vision and language components aligned across new tasks.
Exactly. They use prototype-guided adaptive adapter expansion and geometric consolidation. The issue they're trying to solve is that tasks with distinct response structures might actually share very similar visual linguistic semantics, leading to them being wrongly routed to the same expert adapter.
Okay, so imagine you're teaching a robot about picking up a red ball, and then later picking up a blue cube. The picking action is similar, but the objects are different. Proto-Ada tries to make sure the model can differentiate those nuances or combine them without getting confused.
The prototype-guided approach helps it adapt the network to new tasks while preserving prior knowledge, kind of like building new specialized modules or adapters for each new skill, but making sure they don't step on each other's toes. It's about efficiency and preventing the model from becoming an unfocused generalist.
I appreciate the idea of targeted adaptation, but the phrase geometric consolidation always makes me wonder how much complexity we're adding versus how much actual understanding we're building. Are we making the architecture more robust or just more elaborate to patch over the same underlying issues?
That's a fair question, Sam. The goal is to make it more robust to new sequential learning, not just bloat the model. It's about efficiently scaling up the capabilities without needing to retrain from scratch every time. And speaking of efficiency, the next paper, Ada Codec, looks at how video MLLMs process temporal data.
This one seemed pretty straightforward to me, honestly. Video is redundant. Why are we encoding every single frame from scratch if most of the scene hasn't changed? It's like sending an entire painting when you only need to describe a new brushstroke.
Which is insane when you think about it. Ada Codec proposes a predictive visual code for video MLLMs. Instead of encoding each frame independently, they suggest only sending a full reference frame when the scene can't be predicted well from prior context, and otherwise transmitting a compact description of inter-frame changes.
That just makes sense. It's how video compression works, essentially. But to build that directly into the MLLM's visual processing pipeline, that implies a deeper understanding of temporal coherence than just throwing frames at it.
It does. It means the model itself is learning to predict what's coming next and only requesting new, full information when that prediction breaks down. It's a more active, less passive way of consuming visual data over time. It makes the MLLM a more efficient observer.
More efficient, definitely, but also more susceptible to cumulative errors if its predictions start to diverge from reality, right? Like if the predictive code is slightly off, that error could propagate over many frames until it finally requests a new reference frame.
That's a potential risk, yes, but the benefit is a significant reduction in computational load and token usage, which is a major bottleneck for video MLLMs right now. It means you can process longer, higher-resolution video sequences more effectively. It's a trade-off, but one that seems necessary for practical applications.
Okay, so we're trying to fix models that can't perceive properly, then generate more efficient but physically sound data, then continually learn new things without forgetting, and now process video more intelligently. It's all about making these models actually work in complex, real-world scenarios.
Which leads us to ClinEnv, the final paper, and probably the most direct application of all this. It's an interactive, multi-stage, long-horizon EHR environment for agents, essentially evaluating LLMs as attending physicians.
This is where my skepticism really kicks in, Alex. We're talking about LLMs acting as physicians, making sequential, irreversible decisions under uncertainty. We just talked about models prioritizing plausible narratives over perceptual truth, and now we want them in a clinical setting?
It's a benchmark, Sam, not a deployment. The point is to create an environment that simulates the messy, incremental information gathering and decision-making process of a real doctor, which static benchmarks can't do. They call it longitudinal inpatient simulation.
Yeah, but still, the core problem remains. Can these models truly reason under uncertainty in a way that aligns with human judgment, especially when human judgment is based on an integrated understanding of the world, not just text patterns? A doctor isn't just processing text. They're observing, they're empathizing, they're using years of experience to read between the lines.
And that's precisely what this benchmark is trying to probe. Can an LLM, given incremental access to patient data, make those correct diagnostic and treatment decisions? It's a direct test of grounded reasoning in a high-stakes environment. They automatically construct cases into ordered sequences of decision stages. It's an ambitious evaluation framework.
I mean, I appreciate the ambition, Alex. I really do. But it feels like we're still building models with foundational perceptual and reasoning gaps, and then throwing them at incredibly complex, high-stakes tasks and hoping for the best. It's like trying to teach someone to fly a jumbo jet when they still can't reliably tell the difference between a picture of a bird and a plane.
The hope, Sam, is that by creating environments like ClinEnv, we force the development of models that can overcome those gaps, or at least expose exactly where those gaps are most critical. It's about moving beyond simple QA and into sequential, real-world decision-making.
Yeah, but my lingering feeling is that a lot of what we're seeing today isn't about breakthrough new capabilities, but about fixing or attempting to fix fundamental weaknesses in how these models perceive and integrate information. It's a necessary step, sure, but it's not the leap forward we sometimes think it is.
I think that's fair. What I'm taking away from all of this is that the real battleground isn't just about scaling up or getting more parameters. It's about grounding these models in a robust understanding of reality, whether that's physical reality for robots or clinical reality for AI doctors. It's about bridging the gap between patterns and perception.
And not getting distracted by what looks plausible versus what actually is.
Exactly. The challenge isn't just making the models smarter, but making them more real.
More reliable.
More reliable, yes. And that's it for the robotics brief this week.
Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next episode. Take care.